All right, everyone, welcome back. You guys know how this works. You asked for a deep dive, and we're going to give you a deep dive.
That's right.
And today we're taking a closer look at a case that's been on a lot of your minds. United States v. Morrison. This one really gets into the nitty-gritty of the Violence Against Women Act, its constitutionality, federal power, and a whole lot more.
Yeah, this is a case that really sparked a debate about how we as a society respond to violence against women and if it should be handled at the state or federal level.
Exactly. Big questions with, well, not always easy answers.
Yeah.
But that's why we're here to break it all down. So where do we even begin with a case like this?
Well, I think it all starts with Christy Brzonkala, a student at Virginia Tech.
Right.
She alleged that she was assaulted and raped by two football players at the university, Antonio Morrison and James Crawford. And I gotta say, her complaint against them, it's disturbing.
Yeah.
Some of the details, like allegations of Morrison bragging about getting women drunk and making some pretty awful comments, it really paints a dark picture. Yeah, it's tough to hear, no doubt. But I think these details are important because they highlight the power dynamics and the kind of climate that existed. It really adds context to the whole situation.
Absolutely. It's about seeing the bigger picture. And things get even more complicated because Brzonkala first tried to find a resolution through Virginia Tech's internal processes. But as you might imagine, the outcome left her feeling like justice hadn't been served. So she took a bold step. She decided to sue not only the two men, but Virginia Tech itself.
And that's where Voice enters the picture. A big part of Brzonkala's lawsuit was based on a provision in the Violence Against Women Act that actually created a federal civil remedy for victims of gender-motivated violence.
So victims could sue for damages in federal court. Wow, that's a game changer.
Yeah, and that's precisely what landed this case in the Supreme Court's lap. It all boiled down to this. Did Congress actually have the authority to create this kind of law?
So it became this massive constitutional showdown.
You could say that. It went beyond Brzonkala's individual case and became about setting a precedent for what powers the federal government has.
Right. It's like, where do we draw the line? So what were the arguments used to try and defend the law, VWA, I mean?
Well, the government made two main constitutional arguments to support VWA. The first one relied on the Commerce Clause, you know, the idea that Congress has the power to regulate anything that affects interstate commerce.
Right, right. I remember learning about that back in high school civics class.
The argument was that gender-motivated violence has such a widespread impact that it substantially affects the national economy.
I can see how they might connect those dots, but it does seem like a bit of a stretch.
It was definitely a bold argument, and it was kind of building on a trend of Congress using the Commerce Clause broadly to justify a lot of its actions.
And what about the second argument? Where did that one come from?
That one hinged on the 14th Amendment, specifically Section 5. This section gives Congress the power to enforce the Equal Protection Clause, which, as you might recall, says states can't deny anyone equal protection under the law.
So basically they were saying VAWA is necessary to protect women from discrimination.
Right. The argument was that by providing this federal civil remedy, VAWA was helping to make sure that women who are victims of violence actually have equal protection under the law.
Okay, so we've got these two big constitutional arguments, Commerce Clause and the 14th Amendment. But ultimately, the Supreme Court wasn't buying it, right?
Nope, not at all. It was a 5-4 decision, and Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote the majority opinion, which basically sent shockwaves through the legal system.
Wow, 5-4, that's cutting it close.
Definitely divided court. And what was even more surprising was that the court totally shut down that Commerce Clause argument. It was a major turning point.
So all those years of Congress kind of relying on a broad interpretation of the Commerce Clause to justify all sorts of laws.
Yeah, this case really threw a wrench in that.
So what was Rehnquist's reasoning? Why reject that argument?
Well, he basically said that, yes, violence against women might have some indirect effect on interstate commerce, but that doesn't mean Congress can regulate just any crime because it might have some economic impact somewhere down the line.
I see. So, like, they drew a line in the sand, kind of saying, look, this is a serious issue, no doubt, but it's not the federal government's problem to fix.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The majority really stressed the importance of balancing power between the federal government and the states. They saw this as a case where Congress had overstepped its bounds, trying to regulate something that traditionally falls under state jurisdiction, like acts of violence.
Makes sense. But what about that 14th Amendment argument? They struck that one down too, right?
Yeah, they did. And for that one, the court went back to a very fundamental principle of the 14th Amendment, which is that it prohibits state action, meaning actions by the government, not actions by private individuals.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Exactly. They argued that the civil remedy provision in V went too far. It was aimed at private individuals, not state actors, and therefore exceeded Congress's power to remedy discrimination by a state.
So, even if someone's behavior is discriminatory or harmful, the 14th Amendment doesn't give Congress the power to just step in and regulate it.
Right. It all comes down to that distinction between state action and individual action. And to back up their reasoning, they pointed to cases like the civil rights cases from way back in 1883. That case essentially said that Congress couldn't use the 14th Amendment to regulate private discrimination, like, for example, by businesses. So you see a pretty consistent line of thinking here.
So basically the court was saying, not our jurisdiction, but wait a minute, this wasn't a unanimous decision, was it? I mean, we got some pretty strong dissenting opinions here.
Oh, absolutely. Two very passionate dissents, in fact, that really challenged the majority's reasoning.
Let's dive into those then. First up, we've got Justice Souter's dissent, which I gotta say is pretty fiery. He basically accused the majority of, like, rewriting decades of precedent on the Commerce Clause and imposing a super narrow view of what Congress can actually do. And get this, he pointed to all this evidence that Congress had gathered showing that violence against women does have a tangible impact on interstate commerce.
Right. And he really hammered on the point that Congress had done its homework, gathering tons of evidence and expert testimony.
It wasn't just some off-the-cuff argument.
Not at all. For example, Souter pointed out that Congress had found that, get this, 3 out of 4 American women will be victims of violent crimes in their lifetime.
Wow, 3 out of 4, that's a huge number.
And on top of that, violence was the leading cause of injuries to women between the ages of 15 and 44. Souter argued that these facts alone should have been more than enough to show a clear impact on commerce. And I think what's really interesting is that he went on to compare this case to landmark civil rights cases like Heart of Atlanta Motel and Katzenbach v. McClung.
Those are the cases that upheld the Civil Rights Act's ban on racial discrimination in places of public accommodation, right?
Exactly. And Souter argued that the evidence presented by Congress in those cases was way less extensive than what they had for VLUA.
So he's basically saying, if the court accepted weaker evidence for those landmark civil rights cases, why the double standard now? Seems like a valid point.
Right. It does make you think. And it gets even deeper. Souter went on to argue that gender-motivated violence, just like racial discrimination, actually hinders women's full participation in the national economy. Think about it. It impacts their ability to work, to travel, to engage in commerce freely and safely. He argued that these are real consequences that fall directly under Congress's power to regulate commerce.
Okay, so we've got one dissent arguing that there's a mountain of evidence and a double standard at play. What about Justice Breyer's dissent? What's his take on all this?
So Justice Breyer's dissent, he kind of takes a different angle. While he agrees with some of Souter's points about the evidence, his main issue is what he sees as a flaw in the majority's logic, particularly that hard line they draw between economic and non-economic activity.
Yeah, like they keep saying that violence against women isn't really an economic issue in itself.
Exactly. And Breyer uses this really interesting hypothetical to illustrate his point. He asks, okay, think about a mugging. Is that an economic activity?
Good question.
On one hand, you've got the mugger stealing money. That seems pretty economic, right?
Right.
But on the other hand, it's a violent crime, something usually dealt with by state law.
Okay, yeah, that's a great example. It makes you realize how blurry that line can actually get.
And that was Breyer's whole point. He was worried that this economic versus non-economic distinction could cause all sorts of problems down the line. Like, what's to stop Congress from just rewording a law, tweaking it to fit the court's narrow definition of economic?
So he's basically saying, this ruling might not even be that effective. There could be ways to, you know, maneuver around it.
Precisely. And he even gave an example. He suggested Congress could rewrite VAWA, focusing specifically on violence against women that happens in places of public accommodation, like businesses, or if it involves goods that have traveled across state lines. That way, they could argue that it falls under the court's very limited interpretation of the Commerce Clause. It's pretty insightful.
Yeah, like he's pointing at a loophole in their logic.
Right. And both Soto and Breyer also talk about the real-world impact of the court's decision. They were worried that by striking down this part of VLUA, it would leave victims with fewer options, especially because a lot of states were already struggling to address the problem effectively.
Yeah, that makes sense. After all, one of the main reasons Congress passed VLUA in the first place was because they felt like states just weren't doing enough to protect women.
Exactly. Both dissents point to examples of like state task forces and even law enforcement agencies that had specifically asked for federal intervention because they felt like the state level systems weren't working. They also brought up the wider societal impact of the decision, suggesting it sends a message that gender motivated violence is somehow less important, you know?
Less deserving of federal attention, almost like it's not a big deal.
Yeah, almost like it's being swept under the rug. It's a powerful critique. But what I find really interesting is that even Chief Justice Rehnquist, in his majority opinion, acknowledges how serious the situation is. He even writes, and I'm quoting here, "No civilized system of justice could fail to provide her a remedy," referring to Brzonkala.
Wow. So he gets it, but...
Right. But he's also saying it's just not the federal government's job to fix it. And I think that's the big tension at the heart of this case, recognizing that there's a problem, but struggling to figure out who has the authority to actually address it.
It reminds you that legal decisions aren't just like abstract concepts. They have real consequences, real impact on people's lives.
Absolutely. So where does all this leave us? Well, U.S. v. Morrison, it really was a turning point in how we think about the Commerce Clause and what it means. It narrowed down what Congress can actually regulate and signaled a shift towards a stricter interpretation of federal power in general.
But this wasn't just some isolated case, right? This decision had to have ripple effects.
Oh, totally. Morrison is cited all the time, constantly, in cases dealing with gun control, environmental regulations, healthcare, you name it. It's like this touchstone case whenever there's a debate about federalism and what the limits of Congress's power really are.
And it also brings up the whole question of how we view gender-based violence as a society. Is it a personal issue, a state matter? Or is it something that really demands a national, federal-level response?
Big questions. And honestly, the debate is far from over. Morrison definitely changed things, though, and its legacy is still being felt today, no doubt.
So let me ask you this. Why should anyone care about a case that happened over two decades ago?
That's a great question. And I think there are a few key reasons why Morrison is still so relevant today. For one thing, it reminds us that the Constitution, well, it's not the static document. It's constantly being interpreted and reinterpreted. The way the court understands the Commerce Clause today, it could be completely different in a few years. It's an ongoing process.
So it's not just about history. It's about how the legal system works now and how it affects our lives every day.
Exactly. And that's why being engaged, being an active citizen, is so important. These debates about federalism and states' rights and what Congress can and can't do, they're not just theoretical. They have real, tangible effects on everyone. Staying informed, understanding the different sides of the argument, and making your voice heard, that's all crucial.
We can't just sit back and think someone else is going to take care of it. It's on all of us.
100%. And lastly, Morrison really forces us to think about how we as a society take responsibility for addressing something as serious as gender-motivated violence. If the federal government's role is limited, does that mean it's up to individual states to handle it all on their own? Or do we need to find new ways to work together, maybe across different levels of government, partnering with community groups, maybe even just having open and honest conversations with each other?
It's a complicated issue, no easy answers. But the more we understand the history, the legal context, the better equipped we are to have those conversations and work toward solutions.
I couldn't agree more.
This deep dive has definitely given me a lot to think about, and I hope it's done the same for you, our listeners. But before we wrap things up, I want to leave you with one final thought. The Morrison decision, it sparked a conversation about how well states are equipped to handle gender-motivated violence on their own. What do you think about that? Do you think states can do it all? Or is a stronger federal role necessary? We encourage you to check out the source material, look into how VOTI has evolved over time, and just consider all the ongoing efforts to address this really critical issue. Your perspective matters.
It really does.
We've covered a lot of ground today, but there's always more to explore. We're going to continue our deep dive into U.S. v. Morrison and talk about its lasting impact right after this. So before the break, we were really getting into the impact of that Morrison ruling, you know, especially how it left this open question about who steps up to address gender-based violence if the federal government can't.
Yeah, it's a big one, right? And I think there was a lot of concern about the fate of VA itself right after the decision. Because remember, the court only struck down that one specific part, the civil remedy provision, not the whole law.
So what happened? Did Congress just scrap the whole thing?
Not at all. Actually, they ended up reauthorizing VAW and even strengthening it a few times in the years that followed. And they focused on different approaches, like finding ways to fund programs at the state and local level.
So kind of shifting from a federal approach to more of a collaboration with states.
Exactly. And you know what? This new direction actually led to some really positive outcomes. VAWA has been huge for raising awareness about domestic violence and sexual assault. It's helped provide resources for survivors and also help law enforcement get better at preventing and prosecuting these crimes.
Okay, so that's good to hear. Progress is being made.
Yeah.
But I gotta think that Morrison still had an impact on other attempts to use the Commerce Clause, you know, to address these kind of social issues.
Oh, absolutely. It became much tougher to make the argument that Congress could regulate things that weren't directly linked to buying and selling, you know, to commerce, even if they had a clear impact on the national economy as a whole.
I'm thinking about, like, gun control, for example. Did Morrison make it harder to pass federal gun control laws?
Yeah, it definitely had an influence there. After Morrison, some federal courts struck down gun control laws using that narrow interpretation of the Commerce Clause the court had adopted. The argument was that simply owning a gun, like gender-motivated violence, isn't in itself an economic activity.
So you could say that Morrison really kind of tilted things towards states' rights, at least when it comes to, like, regulating stuff that isn't directly about commerce.
That's a good way to put it. And of course, the shift in the balance of power has been pretty controversial. Some people argue that it was a necessary correction, that it stops the federal government from getting too involved in things that should be handled at the state level.
Right, kind of like reigning in federal power.
Yeah, but then others see it as a step backward, that it limits the ability of the federal government to address issues that maybe states aren't equipped to handle on their own.
Things that maybe need a nationwide approach.
Exactly. Things like, say, environmental protection or health care. And the debate continues today. Morrison comes up all the time in legal discussions about all sorts of things. Environmental regulations, health care laws. It's become this essential case for understanding the whole relationship between the federal government and state power.
So after all this, you know, talk about legal arguments and court opinions, I think it's important to bring it back to, like, the average person. Why should anyone care about this case, you know, a case that happened so long ago? What's the takeaway for our listeners?
I think that's a really important question. First off, Morrison really shows us that the Constitution, it's not just some dusty old document, you know, sitting on a shelf. It's constantly changing, being interpreted and reinterpreted over time. The way the Supreme Court understands something like the Commerce Clause today could be totally different in a few years. It's this dynamic process.
So it's not just about history. It's about understanding how the legal system works right now.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to stay engaged, be an active participant in our democracy. These debates about federalism and states' rights, they're not just abstract ideas. They affect all of us in really concrete ways. It's crucial to stay informed, understand the different arguments, and make your voice heard.
Right. Be an informed citizen.
And finally, I think Morrison makes us think about how we each have a responsibility to address tough issues like gender-based violence. If the federal government has a limited role, does that mean states have to shoulder the burden alone? Or are there ways we can work together, you know, maybe across different levels of government, partner with community organizations, even just start having more open and honest conversations with each other about these issues?
Yeah, finding solutions, creating change, that's complex stuff.
It really is.
Yeah.
But I think that by understanding the legal and historical context, we can all be better equipped to be part of the solution, to work towards the kind of world we want to live in.
Absolutely. This has been a fascinating deep dive, lots to think about. So to our listeners, thanks for joining us on this exploration of United States v. Morrison. And remember, keep learning, keep asking those tough questions, and keep those conversations going. We'll see you next time.